AM and 90.9 FM HD2 and HD3 Urbana.
Welcome to Media Matters. I'm your host, Bob McChesney, coming to you live today in WILL AM 580. Terrific show for you today. We're going to have as our guest one of America's great writers of the last generation, talking about her brand new book. Our guest will be Barbara Ehrenreich. The book is Bright-Sided, How the Relentless Promotion of Positive Thinking Has Undermined America. Should be a wonderful hour. So hope you'll join us. But before we get to our guest, let's first go to Media Minutes.
Any views or opinions expressed by the hosts of Media Minutes are their own and do not necessarily reflect those of this station, its management, or licensee.
Welcome to Media Minutes, a weekly review of news related to media and democracy. I'm Stevie Converse.
And I'm Candace Clement. This week, a crowd of 150 leaders in journalism, philanthropy, and business gathered in St. Paul, Minnesota to address the crisis of declining local and regional journalism. The Future of News Summit, hosted by American Public Media and Minnesota Public Radio, tackled complex questions facing the worlds of commercial and public media alike. Andrew Haig is Public Insight Editor at American Public Media. He says that the summit came together quickly out of the necessity to address major questions about how to sustain a future for journalism on the local level.
Content has been atomized, and the unit of content is no longer the publication. It's the story, or it's the piece of journalism. How do you adjust to an environment where the ability to aggregate a mass audience and to, quote-unquote, monetize that through advertising is no longer really possible? Are we attempting to preserve the structures of the institutions that have traditionally produced this kind of journalism, or are we trying to preserve the values of journalism that have informed how we produce socially valuable journalism and public service journalism? And I think the consensus in the room was that, yes, I mean, of course, we're trying to preserve the values of journalism.
Those values were laid out by Tom Rosentiel, director of the Project for Excellence in Journalism, as being that journalists provide facts, make sense of what's happening, stand as watchdog, show up and bear witness, serve as a forum leader to engage community, aggregate and distill information, empower their audiences, and provide a role model for citizen journalists. There was also a lot of discussion over whether there should be an increased role for federally subsidized public service journalism. But attendees disagreed over whether journalism should be considered a public or private good.
And I think that's a really, to me, an interesting tension that's going to play out over the next several months and years. And it's trying to figure out where are the gaps in journalism, where has the market failed, and therefore where the nonprofits and the federal government need to step in. And I don't think that's at all clear right now.
The day's discussions were distilled into an instant white paper, co-authored by Haig, which laid out the major findings and lingering questions to come out of the summit. To read the white paper, visit thefutureofnews.ning.com.
The Federal Communications Commission is working on a national broadband plan, and the need for more broadband for our phones, netbooks, and laptops is driving the agency to find new sources of spectrum. And they floated an interesting prospect. Should we use local TV airwaves for wireless broadband? The airwaves belong to the public. They're only licensed to broadcasters. But, as Harold Feld of Public Knowledge explains, many broadcasters don't regard the airwaves as public property.
The broadcasters have had this allocation in this system really since the 1930s and the 1940s. This creates an unfortunately very anachronistic way about thinking about broadcast spectrum, both in terms of what you do with it. You're doing a single thing with it, just sending one type of information in one direction, and also in terms of the mentality. Despite the fact that the law says very clearly that spectrum is the public airwaves, that it is a public asset, that there's no ownership of broadcast licenses, after 70 years, broadcasters think of this as their spectrum.
It's the FCC's job to ensure efficient, fair, and equitable use of the airwaves. And with only a small percentage of the population now receiving over-the-air broadcast TV since the transition to digital signals, the FCC is questioning whether to continue to broadcast local TV in the same way it's always done, and is considering other ways to ensure free TV reception to those who need it. One idea is to auction unused portions of the airwaves off to the highest bidder. But Feld says that is not a solution for the 21st century because it wouldn't bring more competition to the wireless industry, since only the big companies can afford to bid at spectrum auctions. And there's another reason.
What it does is reinforce the old ways of thinking about wireless access, and both that it's a scarce resource that we ought to be paying for instead of treating it as something that we could conserve and move to reuse and not treat as a limited resource. And it reinforces the ownership idea.
Feld wants to move away from the old model of broadcasters and wireless service providers monopolizing our airwaves. He's advocating for changing broadcast policy to make better use of the airwaves, using new technology in the so-called white spaces between the TV channels. He also wants to open up the spectrum to more services.
If we think of wireless as potentially our public square, would we want to lease out our public square because we could make more money that way? Or is it something that we want to figure out how to let everybody get a fair shake at having a chance to use?
You've been listening to Media Minutes, a production of Free Press, a national nonpartisan organization working to reform the media. For more information, visit freepress.net.
The views expressed on this program are those of the host and the participants.
Greeting. Welcome to Media Matters. I'm your host, Bob McChesney, here on WILL AM 580, coming to you live today. It's my great pleasure today to have joining us Barbara Ehrenreich, the author of the brand new book, Bright Sighted: How the Relentless Promotion of Positive Thinking Has Undermined America, just published by Metropolitan Books out of New York. Barbara Ehrenreich needs no introduction to our listeners. She's been on the show many times, usually accompanying one of her new books, and it's a real pleasure, Barbara, to welcome you to our show again today.
Oh, good to be back with you again, Bob.
So the first question, obviously, is why this book? Why did you decide to write a book on positive thinking being a negative?
I know, doesn't it sound Grinch-like,
mm-hmm.
a vicious attack on positive thinking? Well, I guess the idea, or even an awareness of positive thinking as an ideology, started for me 8 years ago when I was being treated for breast cancer, and, you know, was kind of horrified by the expectation that you're supposed to be really cheerful and positive about the cancer, even to the point of thinking of it as a gift, you know, something that would make you more spiritual or more evolved or something. And this seemed to go along with the idea that, or the dogma, I should say almost, that you would not get better unless you thought positively, which I didn't. I felt outrage, I think for reasonable reasons, not just, you know, personal why me kinds of reasons, but how come we have this huge epidemic and nobody knows what causes it?
Mm-hmm.
And also, why are the treatments so barbaric, in particular chemotherapy, which is a real sledgehammer approach? You know, it's very toxic, very debilitating. So I was angry and... Anyway, put that aside until I began to run into the positive thinking ideology, which by now I sort of was tuned into, in other kind of cases of other kinds of misfortunes, like economic hardship, layoffs. You know, where again people are often told, "Hey, this isn't a bad thing. This is an opportunity, and you're never going to get another job unless you're like grinning like a fool all the time." And ready to accept anything employers will hand out.
In fact, this recalls your book, Bait and Switch, which we had you on to talk about a couple of years ago, where you go through all these sort of management gurus giving pep talks to people who are out of work.
Yeah. And you know, somewhere along the way, a connection was formed, and I realized it was the same sort of thing. Take somebody going through a very bad patch and tell them that it's really fine. In fact, whatever happens to them, it's really only their attitude that matters. And they'll only get out of it by being, putting on a smiley face and going with the program. And I began sort of to understand this as a very widespread, pervasive form of, do I dare say, political pacification.
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, the book is detailed and rich and goes into a lot of different approaches and levels on the subject. I want to talk about them in the full hour. Unfortunately for listeners, today our phone lines are down, apparently, so we aren't going to be able to take callers. So you're going to have to sit back and let Barbara Ehrenreich and me do all the talking. So I hope you enjoy today's show. Barbara Ehrenreich, again, the author of the new book, Bright-Sided, How the Relentless Promotion of Positive Thinking Has Undermined America, just released by Metropolitan Books. And I think it's already climbing the bestseller list, if I'm not mistaken.
It was on for 1 week.
Well, okay, it won wrong, but
yeah.
After today's show, you'll get the bump, so you'll be you'll be back up there. You end the book, I think, with the point you were just talking about, and I want to go through really the entire book and a lot of the stuff in it today, but I think it's worth pointing out there are real consequences, not just for individuals' own happiness and sense of well-being and role in the world, which we'll talk about, but for the whole society with this sort of positive thinking, bright-sidedness that you chronicle in the book, for the economy. And talk, if you would, just a little bit about, you know, the role this sort of upbeat, cheerful, optimistic, positive thinking plays in contemporary capitalism, then sort of our current dilemma we face in this country economically.
Yeah, when the financial meltdown of 2008 happened, I was well into working on this book and writing it even already. And then it took my breath away. I mean, here was the denouement. That everybody in corporate America had managed to whip themselves up into a frenzy of positive thinking, and this had been going on for some time within corporate America, which is something else we might want to talk about, to the extent where anybody who raised doubts or raised questions could be labeled as being, quote, negative, and silenced or fired for that reason. So nobody really was listening to people, the few people, who would say things like, I think our subprime exposure is too high, or I think this housing boom might be a bubble. Those people were silenced. We were lost in our, the corporate world, including the finance sector, was very lost in this delusion that everything was wonderful and nothing bad could happen.
You know, I wonder if that's a reason why an issue, this isn't even in your book, and this is somewhat orthogonal, but it occurred to me, a political issue like environmental climate change, which I don't know if there's any way to put a happy spin on that one, doesn't seem to get the traction in our news and political culture that the objective understanding of the problem would demand, because it's just no way it can fit into a happy talk zone.
I raise that issue toward the end.
Oh,
yeah.
You do? Okay.
I just mention it in passing.
Yeah.
But, we are collectively, as a species, not in a good situation here. We may have screwed up our habitat beyond reclaiming. And there is no way to put a positive spin on that way. The only possibility of survival and the only way out is something humans have done pretty well to keep us on this planet for the, whatever you count, hundreds of thousands of years or more that we have been here. And that is by trying to understand what the threats are, what the danger is, what the situation is, and then mobilize to do what we can about it. But not just living either in fear or wishful thinking.
And also not trying to solve it through individuals doing positive vibrations, but doing actual tangible collective actions.
Well, if those positive vibrations would work, I'd be all for it. I'm an empiricist, but...
Unfortunately, your book doesn't seem to make that case.
No. I mean, and this is a very quintessentially American idea that you can affect the world with your thoughts or your attitude. The modern form of it, which really dates to the 19th century, is something called the law of attraction,
mm-hmm.
as if it were a law of physics. That mm-hmm. if I send out thoughts of happy things, et cetera, to the universe, those happy things will come to me. Or, more specifically, money will come to me. Or health, or whatever. A husband, you know, anything you want. So that's a really, I think, pretty insane idea. But it has been, as one corporate guy I interviewed put it, viral within the corporate world, including at the highest levels. You know, that we can, with our thoughts, affect whatever happens.
Yeah, you have a great discussion, Barbara Ehrenreich, in the book Bright Sided about that phenomenon, which I thought was really interesting. And there's so much you just covered in that last sentence, historically, in the evolution of the notion of positive thinking in American history from the middle of the 19th century to the present. And I want to get to all of it. But before we go into the more recent manifestation, because I think that's in many ways the most important on the corporate side, let's get a little bit of this history, because you point out that, as you just said, that the sort of notion of positive thinking and being bright-sided is very much an American phenomenon. Yet at the same time, as you point out, the irony that the sort of founding religious credo of America was anything but bright-sided. I mean, it was as dark, as gloomy as a Bergman film.
Yeah. The weight of Calvinism in early America is always striking to me when I go back into that period. You know, here was a theology that said we are all wretched sinners. We are most likely, in the overwhelming majority of cases, doomed to eternal torment in hell. Now that, you know, that'll get you down. And there was an epidemic, they even called it that at the time in the 19th century, of depression and lots of vague physical symptoms that went along with it that I argue were very clearly related to the acceptance of this doctrine. Well, I don't just argue it. Others could see that too. There was a kind of, they called it, quote, religious melancholy
mm-hmm.
at the time. And I have a certain respect for the, especially the guy who kind of began the positive thinking movement. He was a very interesting fellow, not formally educated, a clock repairman in Portland, Maine. Must have been very brilliant. He invented things, and he, on the side, was also a metaphysician, wrote tons of unreadable stuff about his metaphysical views, which are pretty openly an attack on Calvinism. And then he became a lay healer, dealing with people who suffered from this melancholy and, quote, neurasthenia, these vague, disorders associated with religious depression. And he was very successful as a healer for that particular kind of illness because he could say to people, it's not that bad.
Mm-hmm.
God doesn't hate you. Change your view. You know, think of yourself as a healthy person. Get up. Get moving. You know, unfortunately, that approach did not work with diseases like yellow fever or whooping cough or anything like that, but it did work for this kind of middle-class neurasthenia
mm-hmm.
and was tremendously influential. Mary Baker Eddy was one of his patients. Another one of his patients went on to be a healer for William James, who's often called the first American psychologist.
And, you know, for the sake of some of our listeners, you might explain who Mary Baker Eddy was.
Oh, Mary Baker Eddy, she was the founder of Christian Science, a woman who started her own religion somewhere in the middle there of the 19th century.
And so, as you put it, I think really eloquently in the book, this sort of positive thinking is anti-Calvinism is almost the necessary response to Calvinism. They really are the yin and yang.
Yeah. And it's a nice, intriguing kind of dialectic because Calvinism also, you know, in creating this disorder, this depression and psychosomatic kind of complex that people would get, it was handing, you know, to people like the main watch clock repairman a tool against Calvinism.
Mm-hmm.
See what I mean?
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, it was Calvinism was making people sick, and sick in a way that what was then called the New Thought healers, or the, we would now say positive thinking healers, could actually cure. So.
And it does lead to, Barbara Ehrenreich, to this whole strain of sort of P.T. Barnum-esque sort of motivational, I hesitate to necessarily say con artist, that wouldn't be necessarily the correct term, but magical thinkers, self-promoters, motivational speakers in the American tradition from that era up to the recent past. Dale Carnegie and Norman Vincent Peale play pretty significant roles in your book. So there's a strain of this that predates the current period, but it has changed a lot in the current period. But a little, you know, where does Dale Carnegie or Norman Vincent Peale fit into the current scene of positive thinking?
Well, Norman Vincent Peale is probably the more influential of the two, and he derived his ideas, as he himself said, from New Thought thinkers, vestiges of New Thought, 19th century New Thought that came into the 20th century. He combined it with Christianity. He was a minister in the Dutch Reformed Church, which is strange because that was once a very Calvinist denomination. But anyway, he fused this New Thought together with a kind of veneer of Christianity. And he had a huge appeal, so as far as I can make out, I think it's hard to know whoever bought all the books, but who subscribed to his magazine and things, to two kinds of people. One was salesmen, and I say salesmen because in the 50s they were much more likely to be men.
And the other
was homemakers.
Mm-hmm. My father was a salesman in the 50s, and I recall growing up that he was immersed to a certain extent in this sort of literature.
Oh, well, yeah. I mean, it's hard to be a salesman. I cannot imagine how one would do it, you know, to be rejected and then to have to pick yourself up immediately and be just as enthusiastic for the next potential customer. And so that was an important market. Norman Vincent Peale was extremely popular at sales conferences the companies would hold. You know, because he could, mm-hmm. He could pump people up. He could say, look, it's really easy. You just have to think what you want, and it will happen. And he gave that kind of message.
Mm-hmm. Our guest, Barbara Ehrenreich, you've been listening to, author of the brand new book, Bright Sided, How the Relentless Promotion of Positive Thinking Has Undermined America, just out from Metropolitan Books. Unfortunately, our phone lines are not working quite today. I apologize for that, dear listeners. You'll have to sit back and let Barbara Ehrenreich and I do the talking for the balance of the program. And, you know, Barbara, one thing that occurred to me as you were describing the change and the sort of immersion and the sort of bright-sided positive thinking, as I was reading the book, you know, you make the point, and I think accurately, positive thinking not optional, really, to survive in our sort of culture and our economy. It's really built into the system. If you're not a positive person, you know, something's wrong with you and you're sort of castigated for it. And you talk about those bumper stickers or posters or wall hangings that have sort of the whining with the cancel sign through it.
Mm-hmm.
And I recall a secretary at a place I once worked, and she had a pretty awful job, as I remember. And she had one of those signs, and it was very bright. And I was wondering, I mean, 50 years ago, if we were to go to an office in the United States or a workplace, would have been less of that sort of cheerfulness? Or is how much have this really changed, or is this just the way it's been for a long time?
No, it really grew from the 80s, 90s, and 00s enormously. And the reason for that is that corporations themselves increasingly were purchasing the means to become a positive thinker. That means motivational speakers to come in and address the workers at meetings or whatever, the inspirational posters and other products. Sending executives off on motivational weekends, sometimes in expensive exotic places with people like Tony Robbins, if it was the top guys. You know, corporations became addicted to this. They became major consumers of it. And so the business of motivation or making people feel more positive took off, too, with that kind of influx of money.
You know, I must say, in the book, I think your discussion of this transition of the corporation and the role of sort of motivational speaking and bright-sidedness and positive thinking in the corporation is some of the best writing in the book and that I've read on the subject by far. Because as you point out in the book, and you know, back in the 50s and 60s, it was the sales fleet that had to be sort of motivated and bright and cheery all the time. But the cool management executives probably were sort of laughing at this sort of stuff. They certainly wouldn't think it applied to them. But all that really started to change in the 80s, didn't it?
Well, there's a book that was very helpful to me here, and a person, Rakesh Khurana, who is a professor at Harvard Business School, and he has made the case for what I would call is a real revolt against rationality that took place in corporate America from the 80s on. You know, there'd always been this pretense or idea in the past that management is a very rational undertaking, you know, that you have to do a lot of analysis and there are numbers involved and so forth. And as Khurana argues, this began to be replaced by an idea that, no, the main thing about being a high-level corporate manager, especially a CEO, is to be sort of mystically inspired in ways that inspire other people. And so you get the management gurus in the 90s no longer talking about, you know, boring things about decision-making, but things about, you know, instant, quick judgments that come that will only happen to people who have this fabulous the gifts of positive thinking and insight and so forth. The executives on their retreats were no longer, you know, going to put their heads together and talk about market share. They were going to, experience a sweat lodge or a vision quest or hang out with somebody who had been inspired by Native American or Eastern religions. And
Barbara, I'm laughing because I marked in your book this one passage you have from a business self-help book from 1996. I always want to read the sentence because it gets to the point you're making. This is one of these books that executives and people in business were buying up 10 years ago. And the quote is, "Corporations are full of mystics. If you want to find a genuine mystic, you are more likely to find one in a boardroom than in a monastery or a cathedral."
I know.
And I read that. My wife said, "Why are you laughing so hard?" It was just...
I found that book, The Corporate Mystic, in some kind of used book sale for a charitable endeavor, and there it was. It made it pretty clear.
But, made the very serious point in the book that this is actually an understandable reaction to the real changes in the nature of the corporation in the United States during this era of financialization starting in the 80s.
Yeah, well, their perception was, even, before the Internet changed so many things, that things were happening so fast, with globalization. There had been these mergers and acquisitions, and you never knew what was going to happen, that you couldn't plan anymore, that you really couldn't think rationally. That was the idea.
Mm-hmm.
And, of course... With the Internet, you had a non-tangible product. You've been, with all the dot-coms and everything. And then with the rise of the finance sector as opposed to the industrial sector, there was nothing very concrete anymore.
Mm-hmm.
Is that making sense?
Yeah, plus there's also this whole point of the stability of the management position, sort of a career job, where, if you did your job and you were good, you got promoted and you stayed till you were 65 and you were retired and went into a nice retirement home. or retirement place, and that all ended really starting in the 80s with the sort of downsizing mania.
Oh, right. That's the key thing to the change, as far as I could see, is that downsizing becomes almost faddish, I don't know if that's fair to say, in the 1980s, and accelerates well before this recession. You know, it's just a regular thing corporations are doing. They can boost their stock price if they can say they're eliminating so many people, blue or white-collar people. It ceased to matter which ones. Just have to cut those labor expenses. And so that posed a big management problem. If before the reward for doing a good job was that you would be promoted and you would stay and, you know, get to that gold watch stage, you could no longer promise that anymore. So how do you manage insecurity and despair? Well, positive thinking was the method.
Mm-hmm.
And it came in, I mean, it's so closely associated, you know, as somebody I quoted in the book said, you know, when you saw the inspirational posters going up on the wall, you knew the next round of layoffs was coming around. Because the positive thinking does two things. One, it was to quell any dissent on the part of the people being eliminated. You know, you shouldn't be unhappy about this. This is a transition. It's an opportunity. And secondly, it's used to squeeze out more and more work from the survivors of the layoffs.
And, you know, the manifestation today of this, and you have a long chapter in this in the book, and I really enjoyed it, is this whole notion of magical thinking, the power of mind over matter, which sort of culminates everything into this recent period. And it's sort of boggling as I read this. But it's also astonishing how widespread it is. And one of the key phenomena you talked about, Barbara Ehrenreich, was a book and DVD called The Secret.
Mm-hmm.
And I confess, to show how out of touch I am with much of our culture, I'd missed the secret. But I guess it's still secret to me. And probably still secret to some of our listeners. What is The Secret? And, you know, what are the claims here?
The Secret is a book, I think it was released in 2006 by an Australian woman named Rhonda Byrne. And it's not actually a book that she wrote so much as it is a compilation of the wisdom of about 100 different motivational speakers and life coaches. And the gist of what they all have to say is you can have whatever you want by thinking about it. You send vibrations out into the universe, and they bring it to you. So she'll describe in her book or DVD, I don't remember which exactly, a woman who covets a necklace in a jewelry store window. So she concentrates on it until she manifests it. That is, it actually becomes hers. I would probably call that robbery, but you know that is the idea right there, that your thoughts go into the universe. The universe is a quote big mail order department, close quote, which exists to do your bidding. So you send it these orders of things you want, and she has other so many examples: people who need money, people who want a boyfriend, whatever, and they send out the vibrations, and then they get what they wanted.
You know, there was I knew someone back in the 70s when I was in college who got involved in some sort of group that dressed itself up in Eastern religion. Now, I can't believe any credible Eastern religion would hold this or any credible anything, but it was basically if you chanted this sort of Eastern chant over and over, you get whatever you wanted. And I forget what the chant was, but it was the name of the group. It was very simple. They probably have a website now with .com after the chant. It was like Nyingi.
Bob, how could you forget such a thing?
I know.
It could be really important.
It could. I should be chanting it, I guess. Nyingi, yeah. Hang. It was something like Nyingi Hangi Ho. And I had a friend who, or not a friend, an acquaintance, I should say, who signed up with this group and was really enthralled with it. And he was working at McDonald's. And so he came out during his break at McDonald's and wants to explain how great it was to me. And I said, he said, you know, you just chant with this over and over, and if you do it enough, you get whatever you want. And I said, well, what happens if you chant to get a raise and Ray Kroc, then the owner of McDonald's, chants to lower your pay? Whose chant wins? And he, I think he was stumped by that one.
Well, it, you know, one thing you have to grasp about the world of magical thinking we're talking about here is it's so individualistic. The thought of another person, another conscious, desiring person, does not enter into it.
Mm-hmm. So there are no resource conflicts.
There's no, yeah, there's, you know, obviously, if I wanted that same necklace that that other woman wanted in the window, and there was only one of them, there would be a conflict, right?
Mm-hmm.
But that never enters anybody's mind.
The other thing that I thought was really interesting in that discussion was the effort to envelop magical thinking in the sort, the Secret and some of these more recent proponents of magical thinking and the power of mind over matter in quantum physics. Which seems to be widespread. And is the reason for that that they figure no one understands what quantum physics is so they can get away with it?
I you know, I'd like to look into the whole thing more. First, they tried magnetism, I should say, that that there must be a magnetic force, you know, that your thoughts exert that brings you the exact stuff you want. But, you know, it doesn't work too well. Our heads are not attracted to refrigerators and so forth. No, there's not a problem there. So quantum physics, I discovered, has filled the gap. And, you know, I think it isn't well understood at all. I can only say, you know, my academic encounters with it were slight, but I'm as an informed layperson.
Well, you have a PhD in biology, right?
So. Yeah, and an undergraduate degree in chemistry and physics. So I've certainly had, you know, run-ins with quantum chemistry, quantum physics, and because it's hard to understand it, because it says things are very, very different at the level of subatomic particles, many people, wishfully thinking, have taken that as a license to say, well, all science is wrong, because science is deterministic and looks for causes and effects and so on, and things don't work that way. They work more or less by magic. That's as about as well as I can explain it to you, but it does drive me crazy when I hear somebody who, you know, they'll mix up some of these gurus and motivational speakers. They'll bring in elements of quantum physics with what they think of as Eastern religion, with what they think of as the Kabbalah, and, you know, any other masonry, anything. You know, they'll just mix ancient Egyptian wisdom, and they'll just, you know, put all this stuff in a big cauldron and say, look, anything can happen.
Well, I must say in the book, and your chapter is, I mean, I'm laughing now. I was laughing as I read it. I mean, actually, it's not entirely funny, but it's hard to miss the humor. But the moments when you're at these meetings and for the research for the book, you went to a number of conferences and interviewed a lot of folks involved in these movements, where you confront them with some of the sort of, you know, logical fallacies and evidentiary flaws, their responses are invariably hilarious as they try to grapple.
Yeah, the most actually upsetting case of that, I was at the annual conference of motivational speakers, National Speakers Association.
Yeah, that's great.
Which is pretty fascinating. So you sort of hear one motivational speaker after another. And at some point, I you know, got in a conversation with another woman there who was a life coach.
Another great term, I might add.
Yeah. A very, very actually successful looking. And I said, you know, this quantum physics stuff really bothers me. And, you know, she didn't quite get it. And without being, I think, overly didactic, said, it just has nothing to do with physics. And then she looked at me in this very therapeutic, consoling way and said, you mean it doesn't work for you? Science is not about what works for me.
Our guest, Barbara Ehrenreich, you've just been listening to, the author of the brand new book, Brightsided: How the Relentless Promotion of Positive Thinking Has Undermined America, just published by Metropolitan Books. Unfortunately, our phone lines are not working today. My internet connection is down, so we're not taking phone calls, for which I apologize, because I know we'd have packed lines otherwise. So you're going to have to sit back and let me do the talking with Barbara Ehrenreich. And Barbara, another institution that comes into play in your book and plays a fairly prominent role are the mega churches. And I thought this was also very interesting, the sort of the way religion in this era has adapted to the whole positive thinking mindset. And I'd like you to talk about that, if you would, a little bit, and particularly this guy, Joel Osteen, who has an NBA arena church, apparently.
Right. You know, I was a little bit behind the times. I was still thinking when I started this book that the new right, the Christian right, was a major new thing going on in the evangelical Christian churches. But no, it has really been significantly overshadowed by positive thinking. The reason the mega churches are so mega is that, you know, there were these entrepreneurial pastors, they called themselves sometimes pastorpreneurs, who started thinking at different points, some in the 1970s, much of it more recently than that, how do we grow our church? And how do we make it more user-friendly? Or as they would say, seeker-friendly, you know, seeker being somebody who's not yet a member of the congregation.
Mm-hmm.
And this led to a lot of changes, more comfortable seats, for example. You'll find in most mega churches not hard pews, but theater-type seats. More special effects and music, flashing lights, and I actually hated Christian rock, the, you know, sort of soft rock interludes. But also it meant throwing out anything about Christianity that is challenging or disturbing. And if you think about it, a lot about Christianity is disturbing. So, for example, in most mega churches, like Joel Osteen's in Houston, Texas, you will find no crosses on the wall, no crucifixes, no images of Jesus, except in the book in the gift shop. There you can buy those things. But they're not all around. And, if you know, why? Hey, you know, that's a bummer. The guy being tortured on a cross? So that all goes. All references to sin and damnation and redemption go. And the message is this, is you can overcome. God wants to prosper you. God wants you to have nice stuff. It's really, you know, sort of matter of enlisting God to help you get the things that are your due. Very, you know, feel good. It makes sense. I mean, if you have most people, Sunday is one of the few times when they're not going to be either working or doing chores or housework or something. And why subject yourself to being harangued by somebody who's going to tell you you're a miserable sinner?
Well, you know, last week I had as my guest the author Max Blumenthal, who has the book Republican Gomorrah, and part of his book is going into the evangelical organized political right. And there was one figure that showed up in his book that also showed up in your discussion of the mega churches, who's probably the most prominent of these preachers because of his involvement with the presidential campaign last year, named Rick Warren.
Oh, yes.
And he's an interesting piece of work. Talk a little bit about Rick Warren and how he fits into the bright-sided world of positive thinking.
Well, Rick Warren has, you know, clearly rejected the so-called prosperity gospel of people like Creflo Dollar, for example, the black televangelist, and Joyce Meyer, another televangelist. And I think Joel Osteen falls into the prosperity gospel, you know, side too. Rick Warren says, no, that's not, you know, that's just cheap. God doesn't want to make you rich. You know, that's a misreading, et cetera. But you will not, again, all the agony has been taken out of Christianity. You know, it is about kind of personal growth and, you know, things getting better and so forth.
No, before you go on, Barbara Ehrenreich, I just want to note that our lines are now working. If anyone does want to call in with a question or comment for Barbara Ehrenreich, the telephone number here at WILL is 333-9455, the toll-free number 1-800-222-9455. We have time to take a few calls if you do call in, so please do. And I'm sorry to interrupt you, Barbara, but I do know there are some listeners who probably want to call in.
Oh, I'm delighted. The calls are the best thing.
Thing. I won't take that as an insult, but I agree.
No. Yeah. So, but one of the things that fascinated me about Rick Warren is he is such a good example of the mentality of these megachurch pastors, and in thinking of himself as a CEO.
Mm-hmm.
Rick Warren hangs out with CEOs. I think it was. I quote Malcolm Gladwell, mm-hmm. quoting him having just had dinner with Jack Welch or something. They think of themselves as being on, the same level, the same kind of undertaking, trying to grow their enterprises.
Well, in fact, Barbara Ehrenreich, I remember that quote. It's striking. And basically, Rick Warren is telling Jack Welch, the former GE CEO, or Jack Welch is telling Rick Warren that Rick Warren, the only other person who has your same sort of pan world view is Rupert Murdoch. And Rick Warren then says, oh, of course, because, we're friends. I'm his pastor, and he published my book. And this is, they're in the same club.
Yep. Yeah, you're right. I forgot.
Yeah, well, it's a story. Yeah, you're entitled to forget it. I've read it probably more recently than you. Mm-hmm. But, I mean, it is of a piece, though, that the entire culture is turning. It's the argument you're making in the book, that there's really no institution that's immune from this sort of positive thinking, this bright-sidedness. I mean, you talk about the actual field of psychology, too, that, this is an area now that's under sort of assault for not being positive enough.
Well, a movement sprang up within the psychology profession, usually dated from 1998, called, quote, positive psychology. And the original intention seemed to me entirely good, which is to say that psychology should study not just neurosis and suffering, but also, happier frames of mind and try to understand those too. I thought that great. I want to, learn all about that. But it seemed, in a creepy way to now, to overlap way too much with the kind of corporate business of motivation and coaching. The positive psychologists provide a kind of scientific legitimation or a veneer of scientific legitimation for the, run-of-the-mill hucksters preaching positive thinking.
And, as I read the book, and you've mentioned it already once in the show, and it's in the book a little bit, but it strikes me that the political conservatives, or maybe it's true of all politicians, actually, Democrat or Republican, but the two most successful electorally political conservatives of the last 30 years have been Ronald Reagan and probably George W. Bush. And they both broke the mold of traditional conservatives because they were these positive thinking, optimistic, compassionate, regular, have a beer with, friendly guys who were talking about how much better things were going to get. And conservatives have been traditionally seen as these dour, balance the books and, buck up with it type guys. And, I was wondering, is there a connection there that, this is how every politics now, everything has to be wrapped up in positive thought to be successful?
Oh, yeah. I think it would be just as easy for overt pessimist to win the presidency as for an atheist to win the presidency. It's just no way.
No, I mean, you remember the famed Jimmy Carter malaise speech that was considered like, it was the equivalent of him, exposing himself on national television.
He didn't even say the word malaise either.
But in retrospect, it was actually, whatever one might think of Jimmy Carter, a rather, profound speech.
Mm-hmm. No, you can't have that. Americans, if you were getting this stuff from at your workplace, if you're getting it at your church, you might want your political leaders to be nothing but inspirational and feel good stuff too.
Barbara, we've got three callers who've already called in. Let's try to get all of them on before we go off the air. Our guest, Barbara Ehrenreich, author of Brightsighted. Let's go to the phone lines now, starting with line one, Champagne. You're on the air.
Okay, just a few comments. I'll try to make it brief. That chant you're talking about, that's, I think, called Nam-myoho Renge-kyo. It came out of the Nichiren Shoshu Japanese group that was, I think, founded in, the 15th century or so, partly as a reaction against the so-called corruption in Zen monasteries. But I got in a little bit late on this. Has she mentioned Napoleon Hill at all? And this whole idea of positive thinking, it's been floating around for so long, and there was a book a number of years ago called The Seduction of Christianity, which touched on all of this. And to some extent, I think it's, I hope it's limited to the Protestant. It kind of appears to be, it hasn't creeped in, I hope, so much into Catholicism. And you got several other callers in it's late, but so I'll just hang up.
Well, thank you very much.
Yeah.
So Barbara, Napoleon Hill.
Napoleon Hill, very big in the Depression, actually, with a book called Think and Grow Rich.
Yeah, and it's in the book. It was one of the more interesting parts of the book.
Yeah, just attract money to yourself by thinking. But the other part of that...
Catholicism?
Catholicism, yes. I so far know of no inroads into Catholicism. Catholicism is somewhat resistant because Catholicism has always validated human suffering, even said that suffering is a way to grace, to achieve grace. So that is antithetical to the positive thinking outlook. I do wonder what's going on at the latter forms of Buddhism today, though, because I don't know enough about this, but I'm beginning to sense that for a lot of people, Buddhism just means, quote, being happy or positive thinking.
Let's go back to the phone lines. Our guest, Barbara Ehrenreich, author of Brightsighted. Let's go now to line three. Champagne, you're on the air.
Hello. I have a comment, and then I'll hang up. And then, if you will, you can respond. I saw a TV commercial last week where a woman was saying, I will not let Crohn's disease control me. Now, that is crazy, because the disease is going to do whatever it's going to do, whatever she thinks. I mean, there's certain things she can do to help herself, but she can't control a disease.
It's a good point.
I'm going to hang up now. Thank you.
Well, thank you, caller. Barbara?
Yeah, I don't know that much about Crohn's disease, but, you know, it certainly, I think, is really unkind and unfair to say to people, say, suffering from cancer, that you can control it with your mind if only you try hard enough. You know, we say, oh, well, shouldn't people delude themselves into thinking happy things like that? But I would have to say no, because the other side of it is it becomes a kind of blame the victim thing. Oh, so you got Crohn's disease? You're still suffering from it? Hey, something wrong with you.
And it also seems, Barbara, that in a case of flu or something, or sort of diseases that are due to environmental factors or social factors, that if you personalize it, you aren't going to get the solution that might limit other people getting it. You're getting it yourself.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. No, I think if you're going to go around talking about cancer as a gift to people, that kind of takes the and wind out of the search for cures or causes. It's dangerous, I think.
Yeah, agreed. Let's go to line two now, Urbana. You're on the air with Barbara Ehrenreich, author of Brightsighted.
Hi. Just a couple of comments. The first comment was kind of going back to this cancer thing, because I remember at the beginning of your program, you said that's kind of where when you were diagnosed with cancer, that that's where this whole thing started. And I wanted to just say that I had the same issue too with dealing with health issues and trying to find websites and this whole thing about everybody is so positive. And it makes you feel like, what's wrong with me? I'm angry. I'm upset because I have this problem. And, like, I'm thinking of one particular website in particular called Crazy Sexy Cancer, which has some very, very good information. I've gotten a lot of practical information in it. But the people writing in are so nauseatingly positive, and I keep seeing it's like they have to apologize for having any negative thoughts. And I keep thinking, it's just, it just doesn't seem real, like it's kind of fake. Like it's, you know, how can you be this positive when you have a health issue like cancer? So that's my first comment. And the second comment, just with everything else that you're talking about, is I think this whole positive thinking thing, and you guys alluded to this a little bit, but really does fit into the conservative ideal, because it puts the onus on the individual. If you're, you know, if you're not successful, it's because you're not being positive enough. It's somehow your fault. And so I think it totally fits into that whole conservative model. So I just thought I'd get your comments on that. Thanks.
Well, thank you very much, caller. Barbara Ehrenreich?
Yeah, no, I completely agree on that that last point. That, it, you know, this is, I think I referred to it earlier as almost almost like a form of political pacification. When you tell people who've been victimized in some way that they should be grateful for it, that's a powerful form of social control. And I just want to, you know, as a fellow breast cancer sufferer, say, you hold on to your feelings, respect your feelings. What I hated about all that positivity when I was being treated for cancer was it, there seemed to be no room for me to express my personal anxiety or anger. And we have to take those feelings seriously. I think it, you know, that's one thing, the biggest thing I learned from the feminist movement, for example.
Mm-hmm. Let's go now to our last caller, line four, Dewey. You're on the air with Barbara Ehrenreich.
Yes, yeah, thank you. Fascinating topic and very timely. I'm just wondering what you think about the defense mechanism. I think that a person who is working at McDonald's and wants to very badly increase salary or position is one that is trying to escape the reality that maybe they are in a kind of economic jail that they will stay in for a long time. I'm just wondering what the denial mechanism, our mind is very powerful. Does it play a role in it?
Yes, I think you're right. I think that's one way to see it. But I would just also emphasize that this, sometimes it's not even voluntary. A lot of workplaces really enforce positive thinking, or at least appearing to be a positive thinker at all times.
Yeah, that's a really that's a great point you make throughout the book, Barbara. But I mean, just the fact that this is no longer like a, really an option. If you're working in most jobs in America, and you have several examples in the book, if you aren't seen as being sort of upbeat and positive, it can cost you your job.
Oh yeah, no, and I mean, when you're looking for a job, whether you're starting from extreme poverty and temporary assistance to needy families, or you know, from having lost a middle-class white-collar job, first thing you're going to be told is you're not going to get another job unless you're positive, that being positive counts more than your skills, your experience, or your background.
And these aren't even necessarily jobs where you're dealing with people, selling them French fries over in a counter or answering phones. You might not even be dealing with many other people. You still got to be upbeat and cheerful.
Yeah, you've got to flatter the boss. You've got to flatter your superiors and make sure that you know, nothing ever happens that disturbs them. Until the whole thing comes crashing down, of course.
Let's try to take one last caller very quickly. Line one, Chicago, you're on the air with Barbara Ehrenreich. Oh, line one, Chicago's left us. So I guess we're not going to go to line one, Chicago. How about line two, Champaign? Are you there, line two? I guess we've lost both of our caller. So, Barbara, on that note, what's next in your plans? Where are you going from here?
Well, recently I've been doing a lot of reporting on the effects of the recession on people who are already struggling, blue-collar people,
mm-hmm.
Things like that. So that continues to be a major focus.
And I really wish you the best of luck with the book, Bright Sided, Barbara Ehrenreich. As I think you could tell and the listeners could tell, it's a pleasure to read. As disturbing at times as the subject is, it's also a great read. Barbara Ehrenreich, thank you so much for joining us today in Media Matters.
My pleasure.
Good luck with the book. I'm Bob McChesney. I want to thank Melissa Trentz for being my producer and doing a great job, and the engineer, Kyle Kroha. Join us, please, 1 week from today, 167 hours. We'll have another Media Matters for you. Bye-bye, everyone. Thank you.
Today's broadcast is made possible with support from Mike Weaver Ballroom Dance, private instruction for social or competitive dancing, weddings, or other special events, lessons for singles or couples, beginners or advanced of all ages. Information at 378-4601 or on your web, search at Mike Weaver Ballroom Dance.
In the weather forecast for the Champaign-Urbana area, today will be beautiful, mostly sunny with a high of 59 degrees. Tonight, partly cloudy skies with a low of 40. Monday, partly sunny with a high of 56. Monday night, mostly cloudy with a low of 44. Tuesday, mostly cloudy with rain in the afternoon and a high of 51. This is Illinois Public Media, WILL, 580 AM and 90.5.